Okay, for those who are need syllabi, Rossio has both the big master syllabus and the one pager that we're using for this semester. So I suggested last time that reason that is certain of itself means that individuals have some certainty, which Hegel here begins with the idea of instinctive or presupposed certainty, that their ways of looking at the world will in fact be confirmed by the world, that there is an integral relationship between mind and world. That's presumed to be the case. And for reasons I spelled out, Hegel thinks that looking at the actual efforts to work out that presumed interrelation of mind and world, of finding oneself as rational being with universal powers confirmed by the structure of the world, is best pursued by looking at actual practices of that, rather than the philosophers, rather than looking at the history of philosophy from Descartes to Kant. He rather looks first at a series of sciences and then at a series of ethical practices that operate on this basis. And I suggest that all these are going to fail, in part because they are going to fail to recognize that their standing as rational beings has been always already made possible by a history and the society that they are in. So my shorthand way of saying it is, the thing that science forgets is the practice of science. That's what science can't account for. Even if it can account for all the causal laws of the world and how it works and everything else, it can't account for science as a social practice that grew up at a time and a place, and that its rational confidence and its procedures are in fact thoroughly historical and social. So the initial attempts to work this out, I thought the best way of thinking about them was to think about what Foucault talks about in The Transcendental and Its Doubles. That is, that moment that actually lasted, well, until now, if truth be told, in which each of the various sciences, physics, biology, psychology, doesn't matter, pick any science you wish, even history, takes itself to be the transcendental science. That is, takes itself to be that which can account for the world and itself. Right? So there's a kind of transcendental doubling, that is, a lifting up. I mean, the reason Foucault puts it the way he does is you take something that's an empirical practice, say the practice of physics, and you give it transcendental status. That is, you give it a philosophical claim to say that it is not just an account of an object, but an account of the possibility of objects in general. Right? So you give it a kind of overgoing universality. And in the case of physics, I suggested that a problem that comes up over and over again, that physics always misses out on the sensuous particularity of objects. That by making them subject to causal law, it loses their concrete particular characteristics, that is, the very thing with which the scientist begins with. So that science's very universalism, and this is going to come back to haunt all the sciences in a way, this is indeed what positivism is. Positivism is a generalization of the methodology of physics as applied to all other disciplines, and what that practice involves is a recurrent incapacity or even forgetfulness of particularity. So the very thing it thinks it's getting at, it systematically misses. In the case of biology, Hegel begins with the thought, I said, that in fact there's a greater prima facie plausibility than the case of physics, because at least the idea of reason as purposive gets exemplified in looking at a world that itself is purposive. So that there is really, if you wish, a kind of fitness of the world for a reason that operates like that. So the very purposes of nature turns out to be at one with the purposiveness of reason. The problem with biology and the way that Hegel spins it out, in fact, is remarkably close to my kind of favorite work of recent years in the philosophy of biology, namely Jean Dupré's The Disorder of Things. Terrific work in philosophy of biology. And the argument is that what goes wrong is the presumption of essentialism, that objects have essences. And where the problem of essentialism, because if you're going to imagine a purely law-like biology, you're going to have to imagine that every single object is fully determined by some laws. In order for that to be the case, then it's got to have some determinacy in itself, that it has to have some essential features that we can categorize. And what screws up essentialism for biology are, as we might put it, ecological issues. So although Hegel is here being very skeptical about the possibility of evolutionary biology, since there was none in his time, his point, the one he's trying to make, carries through to the idea that such a science cannot be a thoroughgoing law-like one, because ecological habitats are never either spatially or temporally fixed. In Dupré's way of talking about this, he says, look, as a matter of fact, biology has to work with two different temporal frameworks. It has to do the long durée of the evolution of the species and the short durée of what goes on in an ecological habitat. And there's no way of, as it were, squaring those, that they each have their own as it were, temporal logic, and those logics are simply distinct. So it turns out that there is no unique way of accounting for the behavior of an organism, because on the one hand, an organism needs to be accounted for in terms of the longer array of evolution, and on the other hand, it needs to be accounted for in terms of its role within a local habitat. And therefore, there's always a moment of, let's call it looseness of fit, a moment of excess. Again, something, as it were, misses or seeps through the law-like determination. And that will be, in a way, something that Hegel surprisingly is wanting to concede. People often think of Hegel as, because of his rationalism, as thinking everything must be determinate. But I take it that the one thing he agrees with Schelling about is that reality is born as not I, as reality is born from the Big Bang, from evolution, from nature, and that that past of reason is never completely absorbed. That there is always an excess, which is simply to say we do not, to use Hegelian language now, we do not find ourselves, we do not find full satisfaction in seeing ourselves in nature. We do not find ourselves wholly mirrored in accounting for ourselves as natural beings, that there is some way in which ourselves as rational creatures, right, and as natural creatures, never perfectly lines up. So at that moment, Hegel takes it that we cannot capture or get reassurance about our rationality by looking at the world. And that if reason is going to get reassurance about itself, it might do better through self-examination. That is, it might take itself as its object and see if in examining itself that it can find a match between, again, its assumption of its rationality and its conception of its object. And the first way that Hegel does this, and does it incredibly briefly, which always surprises people, is a brief consideration of logic. And given that he went on to write this endless book called The Logic, Science of Logic, you might think he was more sympathetic with logic than he seems to be here. But at any rate, at least here, the thought is that the form of things, the way in which we do observe them, gains its necessity, which is the thing we've been looking for, right? What we want is reassurance. We want some sense that the way in which we observe things and the way they are hook up. So we want some notion of necessity to authorize us. So that here the thought is the form of things, the form of things gains its necessity through the laws of thought, which are imposed on the material observed. So So reason is here turning to an observation of itself as rational observation. In order to discover the basic reason which will ground itself in its observed world. In paragraph 299, at the very beginning of the paragraph, he says, they are indeed not supposed to be the entire truth, but still formal truth. But what is purely formal truth, without any reality, is a mere figment of thought or pure abstraction, without that internal division, which would be nothing else but the content. On the other hand, however, since they are laws of pure thought, and pure thought is intrinsically universal, and therefore a knowledge which immediately contains being in there in all reality, the laws are absolute notion and are inseparably the essential principles both of form and of things. Hegel's argument here is, at this level at least, there is a dualism within logic itself. Namely, it is logic is always here, and this is why I said the question is whether his own logic can answer this is a question, is here caught between the possibility of, let's call it, conventionalism or formalism on the one hand, and real validity with respect to reality. And the thought is that logic on its own cannot show why the latter should be the case and not the former. That is, logic on its own cannot itself show why it should not be construed in conventionalist or formalist terms rather than as the structure of reality itself, as being one of reality. You'll be terribly unhappy with this thought.
Just thinking. Yes, thinking very
hard. The thought here is, another way of putting it, is to say that without some further argument, let's call it a phenomenology of spirit, nothing will save logic from being thought of as imposing reason on the world. That is, we have yet to show why that's not the case. And of course, one of the tasks that Hegel takes to be the case of phenomenology is just to show why it is not a mere imposition. That is, the thought that there might be something outside our necessary ways of thinking is unintelligible. That's actually the project of this text, which is why this paragraph is so short. Right? He's actually just simply dropping it, which is why it makes no reference to his own logical considerations, I think. Another version of the same problem, but now one that's going to reach into the following considerations, would be psychology. After all, there was indeed, we might say up until Frege Husserl, there remained a confusion between logic and psychology, whether the laws of thought were pure rational structures or whether they were the necessary impulses of the mind. And then you might want to say that the psychological fault would be, you know, let's naturalize logic. Let's just say that's the way the mind works. So because reason itself demands that there be a connection between thought and reality, that's what logic can provide, then this in itself might license or entail a psychologism with respect to the laws of thought. Flay, in his commentary on page 126, puts it this way: we have come to find rational activity observing rational activity. Implicitly, human activity has all along been its own object, first abstractly considered as simply physical, then as living, and then as thinking thing in the study of logic. Now the rational observation takes for its observation its own activity, which includes observation itself. So the thought here is the movement to psychology changes what we are observing for confirmation for our rational activity. We're going to observe rational activity. That psychology is to be construed as just that. And in paragraph 302, Hegel says, psychology contains the collection of laws in accordance with which spirit relates itself in various ways to various modes of its actuality as an otherness already given. He then generates a duality top of that. I won't read it, just Hegel stuff. So let's see what he says. He takes it that a law-like psychology should probably have something like a stimulus and response or behavioristic inner structure. That is, if you imagine a law-like psychology, what you want is some sense in which the reality affecting the mind should automatically, in some sense, generate an appropriate mental response of some kind. And that response of some kind should have a law-like regularity. Otherwise, of course, there's no way in which psychology is an account of observation or perception. Now, Hegel's objection to this is that if you view the mind that way, it's not clear in what sense you're talking about the mind, as opposed to reality having its reverberating effects on some other object in the world. What makes a fully determined psychological response psychological, or human, or spiritual? Conversely, if you imagine that, and there's a flip side, and this is just the way this structure of this chapter goes, and the flip side would be that I'm quoting now from 302, spirit knows itself as spontaneously active in the face of them. and in singling out from them something for itself, it follows its own inclinations and desires, making the object conform to it. That is, it's not the object telling me how to respond. Rather, I pick out which object I want to look at, what features of it I'm interested in, and then go on to do all the various things I do with objects. Now, the problem here is we've got freedom run amok. So what you've got is a dualism between determinism and freedom. That on the one hand, psychology seems to be locked into an account of a deterministic account of mental life. On the other hand, as soon as you allow freedom back in, then you want to ask yourself the question, in what sense do we have a law like science at all? And I take this to be a puzzle about the status of psychology. One might say, or this would be my own inclination, that what psychology studies is not human mental life, but rather the animal mechanisms of human mental life that are the presupposition for rational activity, something like that. Because I'm not denying, what you don't want to do is deny the obvious. That there are certain functions of memory, that there are certain structures of learning. I mean, so there are all sorts of things you want to acknowledge. What you want to know is, what do they say about rational activity? I'm trying to suggest perhaps nothing without denying their thing. So that the uplifting virtue uplifted version of psychology as the true study of mindedness, is, the suggestion is, necessarily caught on the horns of a dilemma. And versions of that dilemma now are going to leak into Hegel's accounts of the two pseudosciences of physiognomy and phrenology. As I suggested last time, the fact that these are pseudosciences in a way only hides the depth of his argument. And I suggested that McIntyre's article on faces and skulls really does a wonderful job of digging out exactly how Hegel's argument applies to recent work in neurobiology and the like. Well, we're still looking in these accounts for a law-like account of the relationship between mind and body. And that the way in which this schema is at least going to be oriented in both accounts is that the mind-body relationship is going to be taken as some version of the idea that the outer expresses or is a sign of or is, you know, causally correlated with the inner. So paragraph 311, let me actually begin with paragraph 310. The individual exists in and for himself. He is for himself or is free activity. So here we're acknowledging the possibility of free activity. No need to deny it. But he is also has an intrinsic being or has an original determinate being of his own. The determinateness which is in principle the same as what psychology thought defined outside of him. In his own self, therefore, there emerges the antithesis, the duality of being the movement of consciousness and the fixed being of an appearing actuality, an actuality which in the individual is immediately his own. And this being is the body. He then goes on to say, towards two-thirds of the way down paragraph 311, to the outer, therefore, belongs not only the original being, the inherited body, but equally, and here's the new idea, the expression, the formation of the body resulting from the activity of the inner being. The body is the unity of the unshaped and shaped being. So it is, and this being is the expression of the inner being. Okay, well, what are the candidates we're going to use to think about this? And the first candidates Hegel considers, and it's relevant that he considers them and why, as a word, they get put aside, namely language and action. They seem obvious cases where we want to talk about the outer as an expression of the inner. They just look like they're made for the job. So Hegel says the speaking mouth, the working hand, and if you like, the legs too, are the organs of performance and actualization, which have within them the action qua action, or the inner as such. Such, right there. Couldn't ask for a better version. Well, that's the problem. We're not going to talk about action or speech because speech and action, and Hegel's argument here is, I think, wonderful. It's that he says they are both too directly connected to the inner and to external. How is he going to manage to say both those things? Speech and action are both too inner and too outer at the same time. And therefore not an expression of the relationship between inner and outer. Well, the idea of speech and action as too inner is the thought that when I speak and act, the inner is outer immediately. not mediated by anything else. That is, my saying something is an immediate expression of my mind. Or to put it another way, speech is an inner that is always already outer. Now this is terribly important. This is part of, and I want to say why this is important, this is something that Hegel inherits from Fichte, and it's going to be part of the long and complicated critique of Kantianism. And it's going to be part of the long and complicated critique of Kantianism because Kant has the thought, as do many contemporary philosophers of action, that the relationship between, let's call it my will, as an example of the body, as an example of my mind, rather, and my body is, I need something to, as it were, connect them. And the usual thought now is they are connected by these mysterious things called intentions, or willings, or volitions, or other such stuff. Now, Hegel agrees with Fichte that behind my picking up the cup, there's not some shadow activity of intending to pick up the cup. Rather, my picking up the cup is the immediate doing of my will. So that my body is the immediate expression of my action. Now, this is harder, and I'm not going to try to defend it with respect to action today. It's a theory of basic action that Arthur Danto and Lucy O'Brien have done a lot of interesting work with. But with speech, it's kind of obvious. With speech, it's kind of obvious because mostly I don't know what I'm going to say until I say it. That is, I know this, you know, when I say I'm looking for the word, it's not as if I'm magically, you know, what I'm doing is saying words to myself until one sounds right. But basically, right now, I'm just speaking. I'm not thinking about it, deliberating, and then telling you something. I'm just doing Hegel talk, so that in speech for Hegel, there's a sense in which as with action, the inner is immediately there on the outside. That without, so it's not a sign or a token or an example, or an you want it to be as a window onto something. There's no window, right? It's the thing, right? Same with action. Conversely, and this is obviously going to be important because Hegel's going to say things in a very few paragraphs, like the person is, what is the person? Nothing more than of their deeds. Full stop. There's no beautiful wills, there's no all that Kantian garbage about, the most wonderful thing in the world is a good will. There aren't any. They're just people who do stuff, right? Kind of get a life. Poor Kant has spent too much time on his own in his study. Conversely, the meaning of what I say and what I do gets taken up by others immediately. That is, there's a sense in which I have, there's no emphatic mindness, not of the kind that we're looking for here, to my sayings and doings, because I do not have, because it's not an intentionalist account, I do not have any ultimate authority about it.
No, so...
to use the kind of same examples, it's not as if when I put up my hand that there's some ambiguity about what it is and you'll want to ask my intention. Rather, depending on the context, it will be a vote yes, a vote no, an attempt to ask a question, a waving goodbye, a Nazi salute. I mean, and it's not up to you, right? We can't go right to Germany and say to all the old fascists, no, what were you doing? And I was just asking a question. Hey! There were no questions, right? It's not up to them. So it's immediately outer. So there's a way in which speech and action have an innerness about them that is, again, I want to say direct. It's the inner as outer in an immediate way. I said it. And conversely, they have about them an exteriority or outsideness that means that they can't be taken as simple expressions of the inner. Speech and action, therefore, at least for these purposes, cannot fit into a natural scientific frame. It therefore will, when we get there, come as no surprise that in a matter of paragraphs, as we launch into the second half of the book, the whole rest of the book is about action. All of it. Because action is the barrel of significant doing in the world and nothing else for Hegel. To put it another way, when we get there, Hegel actually doesn't think that there is or could be a theoretical solution to the mind-body problem. After all, that's in a way what we're looking for here. How are mind and body sutured together? Could there be an account which would satisfy us as rational creatures of how we are intrinsically also embodied creatures? Hegel does think that we are embodied creatures and thinks that an account of us as rational beings must be an account of us as embodied creatures, and he thinks that such an account necessarily is unavailable to theory. That, as it were, if we can put it this way, the relationship of mind and body gets worked out in practice. Yeah, now you're upset.
No, I think I know why I was frowning now.
Okay.
I can understand what is going on in terms of the theory of action. The earlier one, logic, I was thinking about what Kant tried so hard to fit those two things
right
together, and he kept using throwing out all notions of a third thing or any conception of judgment, like especially epistemologically, like with action, I can sort of see how it's a question, but if you're talking about logical laws, like the categories, for example, the past, how can you not talk about any kind of negation there?
It's not that he is going to deny that there are mediations between, I mean, he's going to assume that judgment operates, reflective judgment operates in pretty much the way that Kant thinks it does. He's a great fan of reflective judgment. What he does, and what he likes about that, as opposed to the schemic system, is it's the practice of relating ourselves to the world. The problem with the schematism is, the whole point of the schematism is to avoid judgment, right? It's to get an automatic connection between mind and object via the mediation of the schema, right? Our relationship to objects is never that mechanical for Hegel. That, or to the degree it is, it's uninteresting. It's that we work out our relationship to objects exactly by means of reflective judgment, by practices that are going to be socially authorized, so that they get a whole story. So there's a gap, you might say, between the Kantian account of reflective judgment and the Kantian account of determinate judgment. And if I can give out kind of one sentence, the attempts by people like Longuenet, I think it's the best of all these things, to show that every determinate judgment, you know, has underneath it a reflective judgment, is that it's still determinate judgment that is of a very subsumptive kind, that is doing everything. And that takes knowledge getting out of a practical setting. So that Hegel wants to pull knowledge back into, as we are here, back into our lives as agents, as a moment in a gentle life, not as a separate capacity. So knowledge is going to be part of the life of an agent. That can get, of course, institutionalized, set up, looked at, but nonetheless, that's what it is. So there's a sense in which Hegel's philosophy, in this sense, like Wittgenstein's, is anti-philosophical. I mean, of all things, of all people, Hegel, largely everything else, is anti-philosophical because philosophy, that is, the comprehensive understanding, ain't the point. That is, that isn't going to give us what we think it's going to give us. Only practice can give us what we are looking for. And philosophy is just going to be a certain shadow of certain types of practices. That's going to be the way it's going to run out. So, but the question here, or what's happening here, this is a kind of turning point in the book. It's a question of, and maybe we can understand now why Hegel decided to talk about physics and biology and logic and psychology and phrenology and physiognomy, because what he wanted to do is push in our face what gets hidden when we talk about Descartes and Locke and Hume and Kant, is how far we can invest in theory. How far can knowledge take us for an understanding of ourselves as rational beings. And by looking at these accounts, the suggestion is that we're not going to understand what philosophy is, and therefore what we are. We're not going to understand what we are by a theory that thinks that theory itself is the way in which we relate to the world. And that should be unsurprising to us, because this is, after all, where we started the chapter on consciousness. That's what we already did, right, when we began with consciousness and tried to relate ourselves, to ground ourselves in the world by knowing the world. Well, that's not going to work. Well, this notion of reason is a replay of that movement at a higher level, right? But now, of course, the stakes are more sharply put. And the stakes are more sharply put because, after all, I mean, there are some philosophers, Colin McGinn is one, David Papineau another, who do argue that the mind-body problem is inherently unsolvable. But it's a surprising thing to say. Surprising thing to say, because we just have a view that, well, there's just got to be an account of how these different strata fit together, how the fact that we have brains and that we think fit. And the suggestion is that there's a slippage here. Okay, let me try a thesis or hypothesis, and then we'll have a break. I think it's one of the things that underlies Hegel, although it's not what he thematizes. It's an hypothesis I give the holy, my friend Elijah Milgram always says that all my little ideas have preposterous and useless names. And this is another one of them. It's the ontological indeterminacy of the mental. I agree. It's not elegant. And let me take a shortcut with it. And then try another stab, and then another stab. They'll all be quick stabs. Heidegger says that Dasein is a kind of being for whom its being is a question. What does he mean by that? Well, one of the things he means by that is that in order for me to be a such and such, say a philosopher, I have to take a stand on myself as philosopher. That is, I have to, as it were, interpret myself in a certain way and follow out a certain set of activities. And only in that act of self-interpretation do I make or fashion myself as a philosopher. Well, we take this thought to be kind of naively true, because we know there are certain possibilities of certain types of social roles that are historically provincial, right? You cannot be a witch doctor in 2007 in New York City, except in little pockets of Brooklyn. But generally, there are no witch doctors. Now, my thought is, what holds for, let's call it, identity, holds for all the other elements of conscious mental life. That is, that no mental item is naturally or essentially the mental item it is until it is subject to interpretation. And I mean by that that even when I have a feeling, until I actually do a lot of work, very often, let's call it analysis, so after I see my shrink, I may know that that feeling, which was felt like maybe rage, was actually a desire to kill my father. Right? But now here's the point. If I was in a different form of analysis, that same rage could then get interpreted in another way. And I want to suggest that while there are false interpretations, there is no one true interpretation. That mental life is subject. I mean, this is what it means for human beings to be self-interpreting creatures. And I want to say we're self-interpreting creatures all the way down. I mean, that's what Hegel's trying to figure out here, is the degree in which we are self-fashioning and self-determining. And the degree, I want to say, is massive, so massive, that the fundamental items of mental life, namely emotions, feelings, ideas, beliefs, thoughts, all of them, are fundamentally indeterminate, even in terms of their, as it were, status, until I do a work of interpretation. Now, it follows, if this is right, then this gives us all the reason in the world to suppose that the fact that when I have this feeling, which I'm going to, call rags, call rage. I call it a rag, you call it rage. We interpret it differently. The fact that there's some neuron firing, and we know exactly which one, is never going to be anything more than a correlation. I'm not saying there won't be correlations. Eventually we'll get really good at doing the correlations. I want to say, they'll tell us nothing interesting. I mean, they'll tell us things, we'll tell some things. You know, you want to stop your rage? Oh, we can zap that one. there will be. But we already do that. I mean, yeah, there's uninteresting sort of stuff. But they won't tell us about the very thing we're asking about here, namely, how are we as minds and bodies soldered together? And that's because, and what's important here, and what's really important in all these theories, is in looking at the brain, or looking at the skull, or in looking at those objects and thinking we must get those right, in order to get right the material basis of human life, we actually do something terrible, namely, we deprive ourselves of the actual material basis of human life. That is, the problem is not that human life doesn't have a material basis. What these theories do is point us in the wrong direction for looking at the material character of human life. And it's just clear as daylight, and this is where we'll get to when I come back and talk about physiology. But Hegel's going to say that the material basis of our life together is physical actions. if you want to look at where we are completely material beings, we are completely material beings in, and now that inner outer thing begins to haunt us, in the fact that we speak and act. And that these doings are material. material because they're done by fully, wholly embodied beings, etc.
Yeah. So he's not trying to eliminate the mind-body problem. I guess what I'm saying is, for example,
he's eliminating a certain version of what the problem is and what would look like a solution.
I guess, you know, when I read some of these neuroscience texts, I'm, you know, like, not the extreme stuff, but like someone like Damasio, they always come up with this problem at the end.
Right.
You know, it's, you know, okay, we can have a very robust explanation, and even to this point where we stimulate this, and there you are, you know, a teenager,
well,
again,
right,
you know, in frolicking the field. But they can't get behind that. But it seems kind of unsatisfactory to me. It just seems like he's flipping the noumena and the phenomena. Now the noumena becomes, right, we can't ever get to that. So there's still this dualism that he's
right.
trying to escape from.
Yeah. Well, wouldn't Hegel say there's nothing there?
I mean, Hegel's trying to get rid of that idea of that there's a deep inside and a hope, right? The whole way in which I was trying to talk about action as both immediately inner and outer is that's my solution to the mind-body problem, if you wish. I mean, that of course there are other problems, but I want to say those are the problems we work out in action. That is how we relate certain feelings and emotions, how we relate to our inner life, what inner life, the inner life of conviction. I want to say that the big problem, the one which Descartes solves with the pineal gland, right? Right? He thought if you got, you know, something, you know, and it's interesting the way his mind works, because it was so, I mean, I think he thought that the pineal gland was small, if the vibrations got small enough, it would be almost as if they were invisible. Spiritual! Right? He just wanted to go from tiny vibrations to spirituality, right? It was a wonderful idea. Smallness is the spiritual. Yeah.
Is this just another version of the private language argument? Or is there some way in which what Wittgenstein is doing, denying me the ultimate inward
Right. It's. They are. They have analogous projects. At certain levels, one of the differences is that because of the way in which Hegel's setting his up, he really is trying to remove not just a private language argument. That's a bad philosophical theory. He's trying to deconstruct what appears to be a standard philosophical problem, and he thinks that the philosophical problem emerges from, and this is why it's not the private language argument, wrong stance. That is, viewing our relationship to the world as contemplative rather than praxial. So what Hegel is trying to ask is, what happens, and this is why he's the father of pragmatism, what happens if you make a massive, you know, and he's trying to make us do it, I mean, he's trying to make us do it in these chapters, do a massive praxial shift, that is, begin to really see that we must understand ourselves as agents and not as contemplative knowers. It's not that we don't know anything. We know everything we thought we knew before. It's just that knowing now has to take on a different stance and meaning. Okay, let's have a break. Unsurprisingly, I was going to start with physiognomy, and I haven't got there. We'll get there. But we can go now quickly, because this is really the point I wanted to make about.